Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
Why shouldn't the author of The Possessed, an ode to Russian literature, name her debut novel after another Dostoevsky masterpiece? Elif Batuman will be here to talk about her new book, The Idiot.
When I looked back at the book that became The Idiot, it was so much written about the end of the Iron Curtain and the idea of this end of the Soviet Union and this beginning of a new kind of unmarked time that now seems very foreign.
What makes Victor Hugo's Les Miserables the novel of the century? David Bellos will join us to talk about his book on Hugo's masterpiece.
Les Miserables does speak to us now, especially if you understand something about the 19th century background, then you can see what it still has to say to us.
Alexander Alter will give us an update from the literary world. Plus, we'll talk about what we and the wider world are reading. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. David Bellos joins us now. He is the author of The Novel of the Century, The Extraordinary Adventure of Les Miserables. David, thank you for being here.
I'm glad to be with you, Pamela.
So listeners of this podcast will know how obsessed I've been with Les Miserables, and clearly this is a novel that you were taken with as well. Why did you decide to write a book about it?
Well, actually, I originally, 4 or 5 years ago, thought that I would like to write a general book about the novel to lay out just why we read novels and how important they are in modern life. But the more I played around with it and did little chapters and bits here and there, I kept coming back to Les Miserables as the model of novels, as the most ambitious novel, the novel that contains all novels. So after a little while, I thought, well, this is silly. Why don't I just write a book about Les Miserables? And all these consequences about what novels can do and how they are structured and so forth will kind of like flow from that implicitly. And so that's how it ended up being this book.
You start the book with an account of your first reading of Les Miserables. When was that?
Oh, well, it's quite a while ago now, about a quarter of a century, maybe a little bit more. Can't remember exactly.
But relatively late for a professor of French literature.
Absolutely. I'd already had a career as a teacher of French and French literature, and it was one of those embarrassing things. and we all have many of these dark secrets of books we're supposed to
have read. Things we haven't read.
But I hadn't actually read Les Miserables. So I took it with on this hiking holiday and was overwhelmed, entranced, enchanted by it.
Why did you put it off for so long?
I wonder. I suppose partly because it never appears or very rarely appears on academic syllabuses because it's so long and because you can't really expect students to get through it. So it wasn't on my school reading syllabus. It wasn't on my undergraduate syllabus. And as a graduate student, there was a kind of sniffiness at Oxford about Victor Hugo. Somehow, you know, he was for the masses, but for us, there was Flaubert and Mallarmé and Rimbaud, and might not even have been explicit or ever stated, but a kind of assumption that, yeah, Hugo, you know, you leave that to other people.
Right. There's this like very snobbish resistance to this particular book and to Hugo in general.
There is. And what is so interesting, or one of the many things that's really interesting, is that when you go back to the reception that it had in 1862 when it first appeared, it was the same thing. I mean, it's been carried on since then. It had just about the worst press any book has ever had.
In France.
In France and in London. But it sold out and kept on selling out, and it made a million. And amongst the elite Parisian literary circles, there was a huge amount of snootiness about the book. Flaubert was beastly about it. Baudelaire was beastly about it. Mérimée was beastly. Even Alexandre Dumas, who, for heaven's sake, is a crowd pleaser too, said rather unpleasant things about it. And yet, the reading public in Paris and worldwide loved it, learned from it. And I think it's very important that we should try to learn from a book that has that huge appeal.
Was it the romantic prose that they disliked, or was it the political messages, the messages about religion? What was their problem with Les Mis?
Well, for a large part of the press, politics.
Mm-hmm.
France was under a dictatorship at the time. Hugo was a persona non grata to the political establishment and the newspapers. And I'm sure the New York Times never does this, but the newspapers felt obliged to toe what they thought was the government line and to generally condemn Les Misérables because it was a work by Victor Hugo. So that's part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But the other part of it was know that it is melodramatic, it is romantic, it has wonderfully simple dramatic effects. It's told by the sort of storyteller we would all wish we could be, because
yes.
It keeps you at the edge of your seat. But it's the last great work of literature for which there is actually no conflict at all between being aesthetically ambitious and being immensely popular. Because, you know, we're already in the age of Flaubert and the sense that art should somehow separate itself from the masses and be a pursuit for, if not the elite, then at least a serious pursuit that hasn't got nothing to do with selling lots of copies. For Hugo, that was not a conflict, but I think this is the last great work of artistic fiction being also a mode of expression for a mass audience.
Unusually for the time, it was translated almost immediately and shipped off to the U.S. And it had a very interesting fan base here. I was very surprised to hear about the ways in which it was edited and then became popular among Southerners. Can you talk a little bit about what they took out and why that made it such a hit?
Yes, this is a really interesting story, and I owe it to one of my students who have started me off on this track, and she actually found some of these traces of the extraordinary career of Les Misérables during the American Civil War. Yes, it was translated very quickly into U.S. English, quite separate from the British translation, and it was published here in a way that made it easy to split up into little pamphlet-like.
So a serialized.
Serialized thing. Although it wasn't a serial, it was never written as a serial, mm-hmm. but it could be split up into little sections that people could buy for 10 cents or 25 cents. So it had the potential to reach a large audience. And in Richmond, it was republished in an adapted version in which all references to slavery were omitted, all references to capital punishment, because Hugo was a lifelong campaigner against capital punishment. And you might say it makes it a travesty of the novel because, you know, these are two of the key things in Hugo's vision of the world. But at the same time, it isn't really. There's a hell of a lot that remains, and that Southern readers, and apparently especially Southern soldiers in the Civil War, identified with. And they felt that they were with Valjean, that they were the oppressed, the rejected, the unfairly discriminated against. And they ended up with a kind of a pun, and a Southern American English pun on the book. They called themselves Lee's Miserables because they were the soldiers of Robert E. Lee, and this became like a kind of a code. And it's faithfully represented in Gone with the Wind, in mm-hmm. which people read Les Misérables in Gone with the Wind, and that's quite accurate for the time.
You talked about Hugo's opposition to capital punishment. He was also incredibly modern and progressive on religion. What was his position on organized religion, and how is that reflected in the novel? And then how has that been altered in movie and musical representations?
Well, he was sort of modern, but also a bit of a throwback to the 18th century, in that Hugo believed in a God being there, in there being something there, but he had no time for the rituals and doctrines and mantras of organized religion. I mean, in a sense, he was a bit like Voltaire. There is a lot in the novel
yeah.
about a God, but we learn nothing about what that God is. The God just is, and you pray to it. But even with his image of the goodly bishop, the just bishop, Bishop Myriel, we learn absolutely nothing about Myriel's sort of substantive beliefs.
Yes.
I mean, there's nothing there about the virgin birth or the life of Christ or the crucifixion or resurrection. None of those items of the stories and doctrines of the Catholic Church appear. And it's as if Hugo wanted to say, you can be a good man, you can even be a bishop, as long as you believe in God and do good, it doesn't really matter what else you happen to believe in.
But he's very forceful in his anti-monasticism in the book.
I think that's actually quite measured. I mean, many people don't really understand why he has that long section on the convent. And I think the section on the convent is there most of all to annoy his left-wing Republican atheist friends, since he's got plenty in there to annoy the Catholics. Because Hugo wants a reconciliation. He wants a coming together. And he goes to all the extremes to show that they are compatible with each other. Yes, he does describe just how horrible this ascetic conventual life is.
Mm-hmm.
But he also says that, you know, until the problem of women's minority in society, because women are still minor, legal minors in French society. Until that problem's been solved, the convent life is not a bad plan B. I mean, it's an acceptable compromise. And in a bizarre way, the convent is one of the early examples in literature of a description of an autonomous female community that rules itself and runs itself. And it's a slightly odd origin for modern feminism, but I think that's actually what it is. It's a perception that women can run their own lives.
Another of the kind of lengthy asides in the book that I think confounds readers is his long section on Napoleon and on Waterloo. And he had a political agenda there.
Oh, more than political, a national, almost global agenda. Yes. Napoleon was an extraordinary phenomenon in European and world history. Between 1799 and 1815, France came to govern the whole of Europe, also introduced a huge number of things that we now take for granted in the modern world. Decimal currency, for a start, the rule of law, a written penal code, etc. So those were enormously important years. They collapsed in 1815 at the Battle of Waterloo. Hugo was a boy of 13 then, so he never really knew the Napoleonic era. His family was split apart by this event and impoverished because his father was a Napoleonic general and so was his uncle.
And that's interesting because that then is reflected in Marius's family story.
Absolutely. Marius, well, Hugo said, and it's obviously true, that he, in a way he put all of himself into Marius with a degree of irony and distance and, of course, telescoping things. And you know, he's a novelist, not a memoirist. But yeah, the education of Marius from being a right-wing reactionary to being a Napoleonic supporter to being a left-wing
progressive revolutionary
maps Hugo's own development between the ages of 13 and 45. But, you know, it's not just for Hugo, but it's for the whole of France. What happened? Why did Napoleon lose? What does it mean to have the heir of the French Revolution defeated and imprisoned on an island in the Atlantic? When does the 19th century really begin? And you have to come to terms, or Hugo feels he has to come to terms with what for him is a very difficult position, which is that Napoleon is France's glory, but Napoleon was also France's disaster, and that getting rid of Napoleon actually allowed the 19th century to begin.
What, to your mind, is this book really about, Les Misérables?
Reconciliation. That the lowest may become the highest.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's an encyclopedic, compendious book that asks us to be generous and to accept that all levels and parts of society have something to add and to give.
It's interesting that you chose reconciliation rather than redemption.
Yes. I think it's probably because I don't have a particularly religious cast of mind. Others, yes, would, and Hugo perhaps himself would have said redemption. But I think reconciliation is what it's really about.
Why do you think, if you had to tell readers, give readers a reason to read this book now, when you describe it as a novel really of the 19th century, what resonance does it have for readers today?
Well, because I don't think that it's lost its relevance today, or maybe not for any time soon. We need to be made more generous. We need to be reminded that society to function does not involve splitting people into categories, but in seeing what each can become, and to always believe that the best is possible.
Yes, I actually find it a very fortifying post-election read.
I've been accused by some reviewers of indulging in what they call presentism, but I think it's entirely acceptable to indulge in presentism at the present time, and that Les Misérables does speak to us now. Especially if you understand something about the 19th century background, then you can see what it still has to say to us. And it's a work of immense relevance, and that's why people keep on reading it. Not just because it's sentimental and dramatic, which it is, but because it does say some very important things about how we should conduct our lives.
As a translator of French, you've translated Georges Perec, among others. You must have an opinion about the best translation of Les Misérables. For those who haven't read it or want to reread it, is there a translation that you prefer?
I would say there are some that you really shouldn't bother with, notably Norman Denny and the original British translation by Lascelles Raxall. Forget them. The current one or the most recently published one that's published both in Britain and the United States by Christine Donaher, is undoubtedly the one that will stand for many decades.
Oh, good. That's the one I read.
And nothing is perfect. And the simple fact of getting through Les Misérables as a translator, because not only is it very long, it contains more different words than anything else in the French language. And many of those words are obsolete. Some might have even been invented by Victor Hugo just to pull your leg.
One of my favorite chapters, this is one where he talks about the French argot of the time and all of the street language. And it's very modern understanding of language.
Hugo was fascinated by the variety of language, by its capacity to change and its quaint metaphors, by the kinds of odd uses people made of it by adding suffixes and so forth. And yes, he lets all that out in his chapters on slang. And they're wonderful. They're historically very interesting, but they're just fun as well. And as you say, they're very modern. You can see modern writers picking up Hugo's cue and just doing that again. But he did it first.
Well, I could talk about this book forever, and it doesn't take forever to read, despite its length. As you point out, you can read one chapter. There are 365 a day and be through the novel in just a year. So, David, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
The book, again, is called The Novel of the Century, The Extraordinary Adventure of Les Misérables by David Bellos.
This podcast is supported by the Shalom Hartman Institute. For decades, the Shalom Hartman Institute has been the preeminent destination for Jewish ideas and learning. The weekly Identity Crisis podcast with host Yehuda Kurtzer creates better conversations around issues facing contemporary Jewish life. For Heaven's Sake, the award-winning number one Judaism podcast with Daniil Hartman and Yossi Klein Halevi features thoughtful discussions on political and social trends in Israel and Israel-diaspora relations. Discover these chart-topping podcasts at shalomhartman.org/podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments. Ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
Alexandra Alter joins us now with notes from the literary world. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, Pamela.
So we are talking about the literary genre du jour.
We are, dystopian and post-apocalyptic fiction. So I'm here with news from the future, and it's looking very, very grim, I'm sorry to report.
Do tell. How could it be grimmer than reality?
So it was interesting. You know, we saw in the first few months of this year this huge surge in sales for classic dystopian novels, 1984, Brave New World, The Handmaid's Tale, which is still selling briskly. And on top of that, there's this whole new crop of dystopian fiction coming out this spring, starting with American War by Omar Lakhdad, which is a debut novel, and it takes place in America after a second civil war has broken out in 2074.
We should clarify that novelists are not this prescient and they don't work this quickly. These are probably novels that were long in the works.
Exactly.
Before current events.
These are not reactive to what we're seeing, sort of the political anxieties of our era, but it is interesting that they're coming out at this time altogether and probably will resonate differently than they might have if they'd come out a couple years ago, particularly American War, which is about, you know, this extreme polarization. In this novel, a new civil war breaks out over fossil fuel use, and this country is sort of divided and racked by climate change. There's climate refugees. There are suicide bombers and drone killings. There are infectious diseases that were eradicated long ago that spring up again. And what's interesting was when I interviewed Omar, he said, you know, he had no intention of writing a futuristic novel. He was really kind of writing a recasting of history because he was a reporter for the Globe and Mail and covered the war in Afghanistan, covered military trials at Guantanamo, and he was sort of bringing a lot of what he'd seen overseas back home to mm-hmm. see sort of how it would resonate with people if this was happening here. And in the novel, there is this kind of shadowy empire in the Middle East that arose after the U.S. kind of collapsed and was no longer a global superpower, and that there are kind of political actors from overseas manipulating affairs in the United States, which obviously is incredibly kind of creepy to think about at the moment.
Yes.
When this is something that we've seen happen with Russian intervention in our elections here. But again, he was very adamant and very almost sheepish about the fact that he never attempted prophecy of any sort. Like most people, he was stunned by the extreme polarization that led up to the election and has continued in its wake. And, you know, he finished the novel in 2015 in the summer, so he wasn't reacting to things here.
What other dystopian fiction lies in our near future?
Oh, well, things get even worse, I'm afraid, from there. But good to read about. Excellent books, just a little bit on the dark side. Another one that's coming out soon is Lydia Yuknovich's novel, The Book of Joan, which is set in the near future, again, where the globe has been devastated by climate change and war. In her vision of the future, the wealthy have retreated to the space station and they're kind of orbiting the Earth, and people without means are left behind to sort of search for scraps and try to survive. And from this space station, there is a celebrity turned dictator who has sort of anointed himself as the ruler, and he's hunting his enemies with drones and things. And there's a young girl who, it's sort of an update of Joan of Arc. She sort of discovers that she has this charisma and this power, and she becomes his main opponent. You know, I spoke to Lydia as well, and she was saying, like Omar, she wasn't really trying to cast forward into the future. She was trying to draw on things that she's worried about currently, including kind of the collapse of democracy and climate change and things like that.
And when can readers get hold of that book?
That is coming out in April from Harper, in mid-April. And another April novel that I loved that, again, might give you nightmares, but you'll probably enjoy it while you're reading it, is Void Star by Zachary Mason. Zachary Mason is actually a computer programmer who specializes in artificial intelligence, so he has some technical background to draw on. But his dystopian vision involves a planet, again, that where there are rising seas and there's whole swaths of the globe that are uninhabitable, and the wealthy live in these sort of private enclaves with armies and armored self-driving cars and the means to extend their life through medical intervention, whereas the poor are living in these, they call them favelas in the novel, and they're just sort of barely surviving on scraps. And in his scenario, there are these artificial intelligent beings that we'd created that have kind of outstripped us, and they're hacking into people's minds. So that's sort of futuristic, but also something that people are concerned about right now.
It makes me feel bad for horror novelists because, like, where can they go that these guys aren't going?
Well, and that was one of the things I've spoke about with some of these novelists, including Omar, which is that, you know, when reality is in some ways outpacing fiction and the news is so explosive and sometimes so bizarre, it can be hard to be a novelist and trying to come up with something that's both believable but also extreme and exciting. And there's also, you know, there's a question, too. While these books have been selling briskly, particularly the classic dystopian novels, there could be fatigue coming down the road. I mean, how much do you really want to read about, you know, burned out, ruined landscape when real climate laws are being dismantled, possibly? It's a little, might be a little too scary and too close to home. People might be going more for a romantic comedy these days.
Well, we'll find out soon enough. Alexandra, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Elif Batuman joins us now. She is the author of a new novel, her first novel, The Idiot. Elif, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
So tell us about the novel. What is it about?
The novel is about a Turkish-American young woman named Selin who goes to Harvard for her first year of college in 1995. And it's about the friends who she meets and her discovery of email and her epistolary romance with a fellow student in her Russian class who she could perfectly well get up and talk to, but instead they write each other these emails. And then it ends with her going to Hungary and having various misadventures.
I have to ask about the word epistolary, because I'm assuming you mean email, and it makes me wonder if we're still using the word epistolary to describe novels in letters, but they're not actually letters, they're emails.
That is how I was using it. I've seen epistolary used to describe a Chinese novel that was written all in SMS texts a while ago, so I feel like my use is quite conservative by that comparison.
But nonetheless, we've loosened up the standards a little bit here. I'm sure you get asked this all the time, but it's hard not to think, well, you are a Turkish-American woman who also went to Harvard. How much of you is in this book?
I am indeed, yes. I wrote this book actually many years ago. The first draft of this book I wrote when I was 23, and it was based, I think, extremely closely on my sphere of experience and on being who I was, being from where I was, being, you know, where I was around the kind of people I was. This is a novel that's kind of been in the drawer for many years, only in my case it was in the cloud. It was just in Google Drive for a very long time. And when I revisited it, I saw that it had magically become a historical novel just by my sitting there. And I also found that by the time I was 38, revisiting this novel about someone who was 18, that person seemed like a completely different person who I didn't remember being, who had responses and reactions to things that I didn't remember, which is one of the things that made it so exciting to work on. And another thing that I found is that actually the experiences, the things that I wrote about, somehow replaced, as sometimes happens, the things that actually happened. So I don't actually have a very firm handle on how much of the things that happened actually happened, or really how much that person was the exact person I was. But I think that a lot of the feelings that it describes are feelings that I actually had, because they rang true to me as I reread them, and I hope that's how they strike readers also.
It's interesting that you refer to it as a historical novel, even though it only took place 20 years ago, but I think that that's right. I think, you know, in the 90s, if a novel took place in the 70s, you wouldn't call it a historical novel, but things are changing so quickly, especially with regard to technology, which your book is very much about in a lot of ways, that it does feel historical. It feels like
that's
ancient
so
times.
Interesting. Actually, one of the things that I wanted to write about in the book was how certain periods of time in an individual's life can seem much more full and sort of historical and time-like than other times. And I think that's definitely true of history, too. And especially with the 90s, that was a time that one thought of as being the end of history in a way. And then that turned out to be so radically untrue that, you know, not only in terms of technology, but also in terms of politics and history in the world. I mean, that the when I looked back at the book that became The Idiot, it was so much written about the end of the Iron Curtain and the idea of this end of the Soviet Union and this beginning of a new kind of unmarked time that now seems very foreign looking back.
How much is this book about the development of email and about the relationship between technology and language?
When I wrote it, email played a large role. There already was this courtship that took place largely over email. And it was something that changed Celine's way of viewing human interactions and added this kind of new variable in her repertoire of human relations, which was already quite confused as it tends to be at age 18. But when I looked back at it in the revision, I was even more struck by how much technology had changed. And I brought that theme out. That was something that was actually very fun to do in the revision. In the Idiot as it is now, the opening is Celine getting her first email address on the first day of school and getting her Ethernet cable and saying, you know, what do we do with this? Hang ourselves. That became more of a framing device for the book than it had been in the original.
When you first started the novel, did you think of it as a coming-of-age novel, or did it become one when you revisited it?
When I was 23, I had just started graduate school in comparative literature, and I knew I wanted to be a novelist, so I took a year off, and I had saved up some money, and I was working odd jobs, and I was writing this novel. I don't know that I thought of it as a coming-of-age novel. I thought it was a novel about life, because that was what my life experience was up to then. It was mm-hmm. so kind of short, and it was written in this kind of peculiar retrospective tone that it seemed very odd to me when I reread it at age 38. It was, you know, when we're young, we're so foolish, and then we get older and we realize, and, you know, all from the perspective of a 23-year-old.
Right.
It was very odd. But I mean, at whatever age we are, that's what life is to us, and that endpoint keeps kind of moving around, and we reconceptualize the narrative of our lives according to that. So I guess, I don't know, at that age, maybe a coming-of-age novel is not quite how you see it, because that's kind of all there is.
In between your starting this novel, putting it in a drawer, and then completing it, you obviously wrote another book called The Possessed, Adventures with Russian Books and the People Who Read Them. How did that kind of fit into that timeline? Did you decide, okay, I'm not going back to the novel, and you were writing these short pieces, which you then collected? How did that work?
Oh, yeah. It was all completely by chance. I always wanted to write novels, and I did notice that I wasn't very good at writing, you know, when I was in my senior year of college, that I wasn't really ready to start writing books. And for some reason, that didn't discourage me from pursuing or thinking that someday I would have a career as a novelist. I just kind of assumed that later I would get good at it. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, then I found out that there was this thing called graduate school where they would pay you to read novels. And I thought, okay, that's how I want to spend the time that I'm going to spend basically waiting until I get magically good at writing novels. So I got so absorbed in the life of a comp-lit and Russian-lit grad student that for a while I thought that I might be an academic or a critic. I don't know, the novel plan kind of receded a little bit. I got very caught up. And that's really what The Possessed is about. It's about this feeling of being completely possessed by reading and by thinking about books and by almost turning books into a kind of religion. I actually wanted to write a novel called The Possessed, which I thought of as a retelling of Dostoevsky's novel The Demons, which is often translated as The Possessed, set in a Stanford-like comparative literature graduate program in the early aughts. And many people told me this was a terrible idea, and, you know, nobody wants to read a whole novel about depressed graduate students. And while I was kind of pitching this novel that nobody was interested in, I managed to write several essays about experiences involving Russian literature, and then those ended up becoming the book The Possessed. And somehow from that, I got sort of a career as a nonfiction writer.
So you've named this book also after a Dostoevsky novel. Is it, in your mind, a modern interpretation of The Idiot?
Actually, the way the title came about was I was working on another autobiographical-type novel about a Turkish-American writer for a New Yorker-like publication in Istanbul around 2010, 2013, in that period of time. And she, like me, was the author of an interconnected series of essays about Russian literature. Only for her, instead of being called The Possessed, they were called The Idiot. And that was just kind of, it seemed very funny to me that the novel name of my book, The Possessed, would be The Idiot. And I also developed kind of an affectionate feeling toward the kind of person who would write an autobiographical novel called The Idiot. That person just took a little place in my mind. And then when I revisited this novel from many years ago, this college novel, one of the things I realized as I read it was that I think one of the reasons that I wasn't able to finish it when I started it was because I was so embarrassed about all of the foolish things that I did when I was younger. And I had made some effort at age 23 to distance myself from those things and to distance the narrator from the things that the narrated subject was doing. And when I reread it, I thought that distancing seemed very alienating to me, and I wanted to be there in that very uncomfortable place with this kind of lost, very vulnerable, misinformed and misinterpreting 18-year-old person. And as I was rereading the manuscript or the draft and editing it and having that experience, I realized, oh, this book is The Idiot. It's because that's what's valuable to me, is the very places where her knowledge and understanding is inadequate to explain the world that she sees around her.
There's so much charm in the prose of this book and in the voice of your heroine. Would you read to us a portion from the book?
Oh, absolutely. It's in the bottom of my backpack, but let me
go ahead and dig.
Okay, I'm going to read from Celine's first week of college when she's choosing classes. When it came time to choose classes, everyone said it was of utmost importance to apply to freshman seminars, because otherwise it could be years before you had a chance to work with senior faculty. I applied to 3 literature seminars and got called in for 1 interview. I reported to the top floor of a cold white building where I shivered for 20 minutes on a leather sofa under a skylight, wondering if I was in the right place. There were some strange newspapers on the coffee table. That was the first time I saw the Times Literary Supplement. I couldn't understand anything in the Times Literary Supplement. A door opened and the professor called me in. He extended his hand, an enormous hand, on an incredibly skinny, pale wrist, further dwarfed by a gigantic overcoat. "I don't think I should shake your hand," I said. "I have this cold." Then I had a violent fit of sneezing. The professor looked startled, but recovered quickly. "Gesundheit," he said urbanely. "I'm sorry you aren't feeling well. These first days of college can be rough on the immune system." "So I'm learning," I said. "Well, that's what it's all about," he said. "Learning. Ha ha. Ha ha," I said. "Well, let's get down to business. From your application, you seem to be very creative. I enjoyed your creative application essay. My only concern is that you realize this seminar is an academic class, not a creative class." "Right," I said, nodding energetically and trying to determine whether any of the rectangles in my peripheral vision was a box of tissues. Unfortunately, they were all books. The professor was talking about the differences between creative and academic writing. I kept nodding. I was thinking about the structural equivalences between a tissue box and a book. Both consisted of slips of white paper in a cardboard case, yet, and this was ironic, there was very little functional equivalence, especially if the book wasn't yours. These were the kinds of things I thought about all the time, even though they were neither pleasant nor useful. That's where I'm going to stop.
That's great. I think that you have basically effectively recommended your book to listeners. But as long as I have you, and given that 2 of your books are named after Dostoevsky novels, I have to ask, do you have a favorite novel by Dostoevsky?
Oh my God, they're all so great. The first one I read was Crime and Punishment, and that was the one that really struck me at that early moment of youth when I think one is especially receptive to Dostoevsky. So that has a special place in my heart. And then Brothers Karamazov, I TA'd in an amazing lecture class by Monica Greenleaf at Stanford. And that was when I kind of acquired a more adult theoretical understanding of Dostoevsky. So I would say those 2 are my favorites.
All right. Well, that brings us back full circle to your new novel and your debut novel, The Idiot. Elif, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. This is a pleasure.
Elif Batuman's new novel, The Idiot, is reviewed this week in the Book Review. My colleagues Greg Coles, Jen Salai, and Parul Sehgal join us now to talk about what we're reading. Hi, guys.
Hey, Pamela.
Hi, Pamela.
All right, let's start with Greg because we want to just get through The Power Broker.
Yes, I am back to Robert Moses. You may remember last time I had taken a break from The Power Broker to start Hilary Mantel's novel, A Place of Greater Safety, about the French Revolution. And I thought I might follow that up with another book about the French Revolution that I've never gotten around to, A Tale of Two Cities, which I have now bought and left prominently on my bedside table as a kind of prompt, like a to-do list. But instead, I'm back to A Tale of One City with Robert Moses in New York. I'm about 750 pages in now.
You're more than halfway through. We can see it. It's here on the table. Like,
oh God, I can't take any more credit.
I'm bigger on the left than on the right.
I've got it marked at page 756. That's about 2/3 of the way in. And
it's not 2/3. So not 2/3.
I am foundering a little bit, to be honest. Any story this long is going to have its doldrums. And where I am now, Moses has long since become so powerful and so unstoppable in his drive to remake the city that it's starting to feel a little repetitive. Like, wait a minute, which bridge are we talking about now? Is this the Triborough or the Verrazano? Or he built them all.
Right.
And with the same methods, the same pressure that he brought to bear on the just kind of rolling everyone over.
Moses is timely, but he's a little bit in the news, like especially timely right now, because they are, or at least Governor Cuomo has endorsed a plan to tear down the Sheridan Expressway.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Indeed. We'll see if it happens.
they've undone some of the things that when Caro wrote this book were held up as great accomplishments. The New York Convention Center, which is now just Columbus Circle, the Time Warner Center, that was kind of the big coliseum of its time, and it was knocked down well after this book came out.
So one criticism, one point you made about the book is that we don't get so deep into the psychology.
Yeah,
is he getting
the emotional.
Now?
That's no, right. Well, no, I mean, it's not deep into the psychology, and you get the sense that however complex Moses might have been, Caro paints this picture of him as just very arrogant and power-hungry genius, but you get this over and over and over again. So he doesn't kind of explore the layers of that, and he rests on kind of a genealogical answer to that. His mother was arrogant and power-hungry and a genius, and his grandmother was arrogant and power-hungry and a genius. And so it's just kind of the destiny of this
family. The way they were.
Yes, exactly. So I've been reading this on the train, and last week another passenger kind of lit up when he saw that. He said, "It's such an incredible book." And when I agreed, he added, "It's so incredibly well researched," which is true, of course. But my answer was that it's also incredibly well written. And since I said that, I've been reading with one eye especially alert to Robert Caro's language, because it's not well written in the normal sense that it's stylish or lyrical or striking. He repeats himself, and he tends to drone a bit, like the narrator of like a nature documentary. What makes it well written is Caro's absolute command of the material and his authority and organization in laying it out. It's like reading a 1,300-page legal brief.
Yeah. You're selling it, Greg. You're selling it all over the place.
It's so lucid and persuasive, and it's just a joy to follow along. So in this case, well-researched and well-written pretty much amount to the same thing, even in the doldrums. And I have to say, I don't know if this is Caro or Bob Gottlieb who edited the book at Knopf, but to his credit, he seems to have a sense when Moses himself has become less than interesting, and he breaks up those passages with fascinating little detours. Like this morning I was reading about the mafia-connected wartime mayor William O'Dwyer, who eventually flees to Mexico and pined for New York the rest of his life. And I didn't know anything about him. I had never even heard of him before. And Caro has such a nice way with quick characterization. You wouldn't think he can do anything quickly. But just listen to this footnote about the mayor in exile. "In the bedroom of O'Dwyer's luxurious Mexico City penthouse was an old trunk, which contained a faded photograph of a young, handsome patrolman on the beat at Bush Terminal in 1917. That's O'Dwyer himself. Magistrate O'Dwyer's black robe, and a glittering golden badge embossed with the seal of the city, the word chief, and five silver stars. Once, with a visitor present, O'Dwyer opened the trunk, put on the black robe, and sat staring in silence at the shield. 'The badge of the mayor of the city of New York,' he said at last, softly."
Something to think about. All right, yeah. Thanks, Greg. Jen, what are you reading?
So I'm about a third of a way through of the novel A Separation by Katie Kitamura, which came out, I think, last month, so it's fairly recent. And it's the story of a woman who has been separated from her husband for about 6 months, but it's all been secret. They haven't told anyone. And then she receives a call from her mother-in-law, who doesn't know about the separation, who asks what happened to the husband, because apparently he's gone missing on a trip to Greece. And so the woman goes to Greece ostensibly to find him, ostensibly to tell her mother-in-law what happened to him, but really to, I think, ask for a divorce. And so I'm just at the point at which she's starting to meet the locals and traveling through the area. And it's actually done in such a way where the character herself, there's a certain affectlessness to it that I find very appealing.
Did you read this too, Pearl?
Yeah, I have read it.
Yeah.
And it's a tone.
This is one of those that you mentioned. There's this string
women
of Greek
running off
novels.
To Greece.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's
well,
a
it's like
Kara Hopkins
like other
running.
Yeah, that's
and,
right. Yeah.
Right, Rachel Cusk,
right.
Of course. Yeah.
And
yeah.
Again, with the Cusk, that certain kind of like, who
yes.
are you in the voice, right?
Yes.
That like chill, that sort of like.
Which I really like. I mean,
yeah.
I could see how it's the kind of voice where some readers might just sort of label her a cipher and leave it
yeah.
at that. But I actually think that she's like doing something really interesting with it. So.
And it's unsettling.
Yes.
You know?
Very unsettling.
And I think it's like one of those things where like, I think the book has kind of been strangely marketed sometimes where it's it's not a thriller. Like, there is a mystery,
yes,
right? But I know that for, like, some people are like, oh, is this, like, another Gone Girl? It's not that, but it does have that kind of, like, suspenseful propulsion. And
yes, definitely.
All right, Parle has gone from walking into here with big fat novels, sometimes two of them, to coming with regular sized novels.
Not even, just my
novellas. She is here today with a piece of paper.
That's right.
Parle, what piece of paper are you reading?
Next week it'll be a post-it. So I'm not going to talk about books because everything that I'm, all the books that I'm reading to preview, to assign, or I'm reviewing. So I needed a little bit of a palate cleanser. That is an awful choice of words for what I'm actually reading. But so I'm getting excited for David Grand's new book, which is coming out next month, I think. It's called Killers of the Flower Moon. And briefly, it's the story of, in the 1920s, the richest people per capita in the world were the Osage Indians. And one by one, they started to die. They were poisoned and murdered. Dozens of people died. And Grand basically goes back and tries to find who were the killers. And then how did they escape for so long, you know? And it sort of becomes a bigger story about prejudice and oppression of Indigenous Americans. And Grant is, he's one of my favorite profile writers of all time.
He's so good.
He's rather upsettingly good, it has to be said. So I went back.
Yes, it causes me distress.
Right,
also.
So I went back and I read probably my favorite piece of his, which I hope everybody has read. I know you guys have read it. And it's called Trial by Fire. It's the amazing story of a man named Cameron Todd Willingham, who in the 90s was convicted and sentenced to death for the murder of his three small children who all perished in a fire. And the profile sort of goes from the scene of the crime into how was he convicted, with what kind of evidence. And it's this amazing story of not only his life and the people that supported him, the people that were like, something is wrong, you know, we need to find you support, we need to find you better lawyers, but also a history of arson and the science that goes into arson.
Especially, yeah.
And more than that, like, and I think, and I've read and reread this piece so many times just trying to get the structure of it, because again, as you say, like, there's something about the clarity of it,
yep,
and his remove, again, maybe like even this Kitamura remove, bringing it all together.
Oh, yeah.
But it's really like, I don't understand how it works, because it is probably one of the most affecting pieces I've ever read.
And
effective, exactly, because now it's pretty much accepted that it was junk science. And
it has completely discredited this kind of testimony, mm-hmm, about the causes of arson or the evidence of arson.
It was all old wives' tales.
Yeah.
It was all like, if there's this kind of cracked glass, it means this. If there's this kind of V on a wall, it means this. These puddles. And it's
also kind of a legal brief, maybe not a 1,300-page legal brief.
Mercifully. But, and then I think in this rereading of this, what I loved is just, I think whenever you read these stories about crimes or science, it's like, they're always like these stories of also amateurs, of hobbyists, that people come into these fields. Some of them are professionals, but a whole lot of people just do it out of this strange love. And so one of the people who was instrumental in sort of clarifying this story was this, he used to work in the Defense Department, but he just had this thing for fires. He understood fire. He as a child, used to prowl around junkyards and sort of like collect wires. And it's sort of, he did sort of speak this language. And another person, the sort of woman that kept Willingham alive was this woman who just started wanting to correspond with the prisoner. And then she was the one who was kind of just like, he's actually like a lovely person. She thought he was guilty. She didn't want to absolve him. But then the more she heard about his case, the more things didn't add up. And it's this one woman, Elizabeth Gilbert, who's no relation to the writer, but it's this woman whose friendship, in a way, was so instrumental in
that piece
him.
Was so powerful that I remember
exactly
where I was when I read it.
Yeah.
You know, I have like a mental image of reading that.
Likewise. If I remember, you say this woman who was instrumental in keeping him alive, but if I remember right, no spoiler, spoiler alert here, but he is in fact executed, and Gran ends the piece by talking about the Holy Grail for kind of the Innocence Project and is finding hard evidence that an innocent man has in fact been executed,
and
he talks about, here is the answer to that Holy Grail.
And went both ways. So, I mean, again, like, spoiler is such a, you know, insufficient, but so what happens to Elizabeth Gilbert is also very interesting and tragic. So she was in a terrible car accident and was paralyzed later from the neck down. And she said that the only way she could have survived that was through her friendship with Willingham, because she said that he taught her how to live. He taught her how to sort of resist it, you know, to fight it and to sort of like, and gradually she developed, you know, she was able to move her arms and hands. But she's like, I wasn't doing him a kindness. He did me a kindness in the end. So highly recommend this really important story. Pamela, what are you reading? Hopefully something a little bit less.
I'm going to go with something much lighter. I actually started reading Émile Zola's The Belly of Paris, but I will wait to talk about that. And I'll talk instead about the book that I just finished reading, which is Chris Bechtelder's The Throwback Special.
Oh, I love that book.
I love it so much. He's so funny, and I can't resist reading a little bit from the book. So just to ground it, the premise is very simple. 22 men get together every year to reenact a play that they saw on Monday Night Football. In this particular play, Joe Theismann gets his leg broken in a really unpleasant way. I actually waited until I was done with the book to watch it on YouTube, and it's pretty spectacular.
This is Lawrence Taylor sacks him and his leg folded under him. And I think the bone was even poking out from his
It was grisly. He never played football again. But let's not go to that dark place. I'm going to start with just a little passage from the beginning where they're beginning to assemble in this unspectacular hotel. And here we are with one of the characters, Andy. Andy turned off his wipers. He remained in his car with the engine running, pretending to inspect the bottom of his cleats. He held a shoe in one hand, and with the other he used a ballpoint pen to scrape at imaginary dirt around the studs. He had cleaned the cleats carefully earlier in the week, and of course he had cleaned them after the last time he had worn them a year ago. They were very clean. He wasn't ready to go inside yet, and he was trying to give the impression to any possible witnesses that he was busy and content here alone in his parked and running car. Through the curtain of rain on his windshield, he thought he saw George, the public librarian, doing calisthenics on a berm. George was someone Andy did not want to see. George's thin, gray ponytail was just ridiculous, never more so than when trickling out of a football helmet. Whenever anyone asked George how he was doing or how his year had been, he always replied the same way, "Just doing my thing." Then he would talk in a slow and agonizingly thoughtful way about budget cuts at both the state and local levels, the power of information, the marketplace of ideas, the future of the book, the public's appetite for memoir, the digital divide, and worst of all, the First Amendment. Andy hated talking to librarians, and he did not want to be hugged. He caught his engine, not unlike an animal playing dead. He worked earnestly and with renewed vigor at the pretend mud in his cleats. A sudden vaporous notion, he should not have come, dissipated before it could condense into conviction. He kept his head down, hoping George would menace someone else with his idealistic interpretations of devastating factual evidence. There was a tap on the passenger side window. Andy looked up to see George giving him what he believed to be the first peace sign he had seen outside of documentary footage. George's face was so close to the window that he was fogging the glass. "Hi, George," Andy mumbled. He kept the door shut, the windows raised. "Andy," George said. "How's it going?" "Just doing my thing," George yelled.
That's wonderful.
I actually had to stop myself from laughing like 10 times in that passage. Maybe it's just me, but I...
It's a very funny book. It's also a very wistful book about kind of male middle age.
Yeah. Greg says wistfully.
I know. Says the one man on our panel. All right. We'll leave it there. Thanks, guys.
Thanks Pamela. Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Inside the New York Times Book Review is produced by Pedro Rosado. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.